The thing that people don't realize is that there's a market event usually every 7 to 10 years where the market can go down anywhere between 30% and 50% and stay there for years at a time.
From the opening bell, the market was in free fall. After last Friday's record 108-point loss, analysts had expected a rally. Instead,
it's a panic. Everyone's in panic. Everybody, we're trying to find a bottom. We're trying to, you know, I'm as a floor broker, I see stocks trading 10 points below where they traded Thursday, and I'm saying this has to be the bottom. And then they trade 5 points lower than that.
Probably watching this, suddenly getting quite nervous about your KiwiSaver. So I was just talking to a lady recently. During COVID, she freaked out because her KiwiSaver went down by 20 to 30%. The concern with that is like, well, I've never had this before. Like a lot of people that have KiwiSaver, they invested in 2007 and or later, but that's when it was first made. And they're like, oh, wow, I haven't experienced a drop like this. What do I do? I'm really concerned. And I think as biased as humans, we sort of can expect that it's going to be continually positive and things are going to keep working out for the future. Bro, I'm wearing a Bogan singlet. All right, sweet, bro. I'm going to do this on the podcast too, people that's listening. And I think, you know, Bogan singlet, Grant, just whatever your authentic presence is. I have a bit of a stain here. That's why the microphone's here, also on the camera before. But let's stick to the KiwiSaver narrative. And if you have questions at the end, I'll jump back and have a look. So what happened last year during COVID, it was actually 2020. In 2020, around March, people's KiwiSavers dropped by 20 to 30%. Why that was quite a significant experience for most people is they hadn't actually experienced that volatility before. And the concern was, what if it doesn't recover? The thing that people don't realize is that there's a market event usually every 7 to 10 years where the market can go down anywhere between 30 and 50% and stay there for years at a time. Now, you sort of expect as humans that, okay, it was positive before or there was historic performance, I can project and expect it at a certain point. I actually said to her, I was like, okay, I know what you can expect with a growth fund, usually about 6% after tax. And she was saying, well, I've actually got 8%. And it was as though that was like some sort of an achievement. But the reality is they just haven't experienced a significant market correction. Over the long term, it adds up to around 6% after tax and fees. In the short term, it could go, I can't even say short term. Over the short term, it can go up and down. It could go, even one of the providers we used went up something like 80% last year and they capitalized on COVID. But that's not a fair representation. It's not sustainable. Like if you invested 10 grand, you average a 98% a year return, you'd have $8 trillion in a few decades. So there's not many trillionaires. So you'd think maybe it's not sustainable. Now, the concern with a lot of KiwiSaver people is they're either chasing fees, they're either chasing returns, and when those returns change, they freak out and they sell. So during 2020, 100,000 New Zealanders crystallized a 20 to 30% loss by changing their growth fund to a conservative fund as though they could time the market. The reality is you probably can't for the most part. I personally think you can't at all, but maybe there's some exceptions. Like you can even win horse races 7 in a row. Darren Brown, he's a mentalist. He sent out something like 200,000 emails or letters saying he could predict the sequence of horses that would win. Enough people reached out that someone actually got 7 horses in a row. So probability says that eventually someone's going to do really well, but for the most part, the rule is you can't time the market. A good example of that, S&P 500, which are the 500 best companies in the US. If you miss the 3 best trading days over a 20-year period, your return was 3% less. So that one day where you're going from growth to conservative, you're out of the market. What if you missed out on that huge upside, which a lot of people did? After the COVID event, the markets took off. So the more important consideration with your KiwiSaver isn't actually what the markets are doing, it's what you're hoping to achieve with your KiwiSaver. For example, if you're going to take out your money in 5 to 7 years, you're probably going to look more at a balanced portfolio. If it's over 10 years, you're looking at more of a growth portfolio. And the nature of most KiwiSaver providers, not all of them, is that they're diversified, so you're not putting yourself at risk of losing your money, you're just putting yourself at risk of volatility. And depending on what you're hoping to achieve, then you're probably better off gearing it towards a certain time horizon and also your risk tolerance, because you might need the money in 10 years, so you go growth, but you might not be able to handle your money going up 30 or 40%. And when I shared that on a TikTok, someone said, there's no way it'll go that way. And that's just further reiterates that people actually haven't experienced a market correction with their KiwiSaver aside from key short events, like V recoveries, they're called. So sharply down, sharply up. But 2000, 2003, the markets went nowhere for 3 years and went down after the dot-com crisis. 2007 to 2009 and a few years beyond that, is it took that long for the actual investment to recover. So there could be years at a time where you want to access the money, you took a risk with the growth fund trying to make more returns, but you hadn't geared it towards achieving the objective that you want. That's why as you approach a near purchase, within 3 to 5 years, you look at more of a conservative fund just to protect the capital so it doesn't go down too much. Sure, you don't get as much return, but you're really rolling the dice. You can't speculate what's going to happen in the future. How many people predicted COVID? They might have predicted a pandemic, but they might not have predicted mass lockdown, supply chain issues, and inflation taking off. So that was a random rant. Could you recommend a way of going about this, or even, or if it is even worth it? So there's a good tool on sorted.org.nz. Sorted's a government initiative that's trying to improve the financial literacy. I've also got a podcast where I go in depth on how to pick the right provider. But a general rule of thumb, if you're looking to pick a KiwiSaver provider, is you want to make sure that they're ticking the boxes of the four asset classes. Those four asset classes are cash, bonds, property, and shares. Sometimes they get a little speculative. Sometimes they have a small exposure to commodities. Sometimes they have digital assets. But for the most part, they use those four categories: cash, bonds, property, and shares. Firstly, if you're looking at bonds, you can do that by going to the quarterly fund update. Every KiwiSaver provider has to disclose every quarter in the same format that makes sense how their funds are invested, the fees that they charge, and the underlying investments that's within that fund. So what you do is you go through that criteria. You want to make sure there's a good mix of all four asset classes. The other thing you look for is liquidity. So are they investing in unlisted property and unlisted shares? The reason that's important is try and sell a car when you're on an island. There's no market. It's not worth anything unless there's someone to pay something for it. So when you see unlisted, that means that there's not an agreed exchange, which could put you in the jeopardy of being a lone car on an island where no one will buy what you have. So you try to avoid unlisted. The second piece that you look for would be around the bonds portion. So with bonds, there's a bit of a change at the moment where prices are going up. You would think that's a good thing. Actually, it's not. What's happened historically is bonds have gone down in price over time, but now they've started to increase. Why that matters is how bonds work. Bonds are a loan agreement like the bank. You loan money to the bank, they give you interest rate. And then from there, that's how you make your return. But with bonds, it's slightly different. Same concept, loan your money to someone for an interest rate, but then you can sell that bond onto someone else. And depending on what the credit worthiness, the duration, the type of bond that you have, and also the interest rate that you're getting will determine the price that you'll get on the market. So you think about it, you own these bonds, you have a 10% return or 2% return, and before, the market would go down, so every other new bond that's issued is like 1%. You've got 2%, the market's offering 1%, you become the Cinderella of the ball, everyone actually wants a piece of that. So that means you might not get much of a return in the interest rate, but when you sell your bond, you get a good price because you're doing well in competition to the market. What's happening now is because interest rates are increasing, bonds have changed direction slightly. So a conservative investor that's getting an okay interest rate, pretty low, is also missing out on the capital appreciation, which is when you sell that bond to someone else. So then they're in a position where, one, will let someone even buy it? Two, will they get a good price? So now the conservative investor is taking a massive hit. Now, how people usually protect themselves against that is looking at different attributes of the bond itself that will make it more appealing outside its interest rate. Usually what that is short-term duration, less than 2 years is a good example. That means that even though you've got a lower interest rate, the person you're selling it to won't get stuck in it for too long, so at least they have that peace of mind. The other thing is creditworthiness. What is the likelihood that that person will pay you back? If you take risk, if you get, say, it's called the Standards and Poor's rating, or Fitch, I believe, or Finch, where they actually give it kind of like school an AA marking, a BB, or B minus, and the higher it is in the A scale, the higher the creditworthiness. That's not always the case. You got to use your brain. But for the most part, you're lending to banks, you're lending to local government, and you're lending to governments. And they've got a high creditworthiness. And that means it's easier to sell the position that you've got. So you go to your KiwiSaver, you look at, has it got these four asset classes? You look at the bonds, do they have high creditworthiness? Are they short-term duration? The third piece is property. So property, you'll be looking at listed property and real estate investment trusts. Basically, what they are is the same thing I was talking about. There's an agreed exchange, so someone's willing to pay the price for it. So then at least you're not lonely on an island trying to sell a house that no one wants. So you look for a portion of that. And then the final piece is shares. So you want to make sure that you have a diversified basket of shares, not just limited to New Zealand, because New Zealand can tank for a period of time. It's done really well recently, or over the last 5 to 10 years, should I say, in the Australasian market as well. But that's not likely to be the case over the long term. There's no particular country that consistently outperforms the market. So you want to make sure that you own international and national. The concern there, though, is currency risk. So I don't want to get too in-depth and complicate things, but if you have a return with an investment, it increases, but the currency changes with it, then that increase is soaked in by the exchange. So you're buying New Zealand US dollars, you're transferring it back to New Zealand, so you're putting yourself in a position where even though you get a return, you don't get much protection from the currency. How they usually protect against that is with derivatives like futures, which is an agreement to have a price in the future. There's also hedging and unhedging, where they actually own the underlying currency in your currency as it is now. So you just want to make sure that the provider that you're using has some protection against currency, is international and national, isn't limited to specific sectors. So it might own thousands of companies around the world, but it's all in energy, or it's all in digital assets, or it's all in this and that. It wants to be diversified. You want to make sure there's an exchange. So it's what's called liquidity, making sure there's a lot of transactions with the shares that they're using. And usually an index fund, international, works quite well in the shares portion. So you look at all that, you're like, okay, I've got a good mix of bonds, high investment grade. I've got property that's got listed property, there's an exchange for what you own, and it's diversified not just in New Zealand but around the world. And you've got shares diversified around the world, protected against currency, and also there's liquidity, there's a sellability, there's an exchange where there's a lot of transactions happening, so if you need to sell, you can. So you look at that. The next thing is you look at historic performance. It might not be an indicator of future performance, but over the long run, you're seeing consistency. It's not going too outside of the market. For the most part, it's done quite well. You look at that. You do look at fees, but not too much. It's not a huge implication. If you just use the calculator and you're like, I get this return and I get this fee, well, that makes sense that I'm going to earn less over the long run because the fee's higher, but that's not the reality. You know, people pay price for value. And then you want to look at the underlying actual strategy, the processes, and how they're justifying the cost. It's not just about cost. Take simplicity, for example. Really cheap, but there's actually a tax drag because of the way that it's invested. They're also invested in the New Zealand Bond Fund, but long duration. So supposedly conservative, but they've got a longer duration, which puts them at risk of not getting a good capital when they make that sale of their bond. So they've had a significant drop in their bond portfolio. And then you look at the team. So you look for a multi-manager. So you don't just want to have one individual manager that's king of the castle, because how the hell are they going to know what's going over on America? You want to have certain specialists within it and an overarching administrative platform to make sure that they're supporting you. There's also non-tangible benefits where it's like service. It's making sure that, you know, they can gear it towards what you're hoping to achieve. There's education element. There's lots of pieces, but the main thing is you look at the four asset classes, you look at the investment team and their experience, you look at the multi-manager, do they have multi-managers within it, and do they tick the boxes of diversification, tax efficiency, and also making sure they've got the right people that can deliver on the outcomes that you want. Most providers aren't consistent winners. So don't worry if suddenly your provider tanks and doesn't do too well. Just look at the fundamentals of it and it's okay. You might see cheaper thing on some Facebook ad, or you might see higher returns. And if you keep chopping and changing, you're crystallizing the loss on yours. You're buying into a market that's doing really well. And that transactional cost isn't always reflected in the returns in the first instance, but over the long term it does, because you keep swapping out. So it's more important to get the right asset allocation, so growth, balance, or conservative for the right time horizon, and you're making sure the fundamentals of the company is really good. So I hope that answers the question. It's a little bit too in-depth, but you can also go onto the podcast, look at KiwiSaver Provider, NZ Guide to Financial Freedom podcast. I talk about it a little bit more in-depth as well, but that's the general principle. And if any of your questions come through, I can't actually scroll the screen. I can only see the ones that come up now. So what do we got here? Advice for siblings willing to invest together. Is it worth it? Total of five of us. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of complications. The main complication comes in the form of relationship property. So those siblings, you could get along and do really well and feel comfortable with each other, but they may find themselves in a relationship and the investment portion that they own could be up for relationship property. And there's not too many things you can do to keep that separate, and a lot of it can be justifiably classed as relationship property. I think it's much more effective if you're going to invest with siblings is that you model the right behavior and you support each other. So you have continual meetings, like weekly, say, how are you going? This is what I'm thinking. And you help educate each other. And then the other thing is a control issue. So if you invest as five siblings, then there could be limitations on how you access the money. Then also what happens when one of you passes away, like how you're going to structure the will so that, you know, it's looking after their family as well as your interests. So for the most part, I don't recommend investing with families. You can just encourage and support each other on the journey and just only make recommendations, because I find you can't help the people that you love in the way that they need to be helped, in my humble opinion. You look like you're off to the beach after this. I came from the beach this morning. It's a holiday here in Auckland, so I shouldn't be at work, but that's sort of how I roll. That's facts, bro. Thank you. So unless there's another topic you guys want me to go down, you got another 12 minutes, so I can go a bit more in depth in KiwiSaver or why the markets aren't doing too good at the moment. But I'd love to hear a question, because the main thing is it's about adding value to you guys and making it personalized, where I can sort of make assumptions on what good or bad content is, but at least with you I can answer real time. KiwiSaver for kids. So the thing about, that was a question. So if there's KiwiSaver for kids, is it good or bad? The good thing about KiwiSaver for kids is that you're instilling good values and you're limiting the excess of that money for them. So if you start setting it up, there's no material benefits in terms of the government contribution, which is $521 a year, and there's no usual benefit for the employer. If you actually want to set it up, if they're under 16, you get two people together, two parents, they need to show their birth certificate, they need to show that that's their kid, obviously. And if it's under 16, both parents have to sign. If they're 16 to 18, then you can have one parent sign. But the good thing about it is, one, you're educating them in the power of diversification, investment, and how it compounds over time. But you're also limiting their ability to access it, because young people, I find, have a tendency to change and rethink their future. And they might have crystallized the investment when they're not actually going to use it in the way that they thought. So with KiwiSaver, you could have it in a growth portfolio for your kids, making sure that you're comfortable that it could go up and down by 30 to 40%. But averages about 6% over the long run. And then from there, when they're approaching their first home, it'll transfer over to them at age 18. So now they're the owner of it. And then they decide on, hey, when am I going to get this house? How should I structure it? Should I go conservative, balanced, or growth? And then from there, you've set them up without very little money for the most part, because of the power of compounding interest. Opinion on paying off mortgage in the next 3 years and then invest in future with difference after. So the most important thing with a mortgage is, for the most part, it outpaces most investments. Historic performances of mortgages have gone up to 9 or 11%, average about 6.6% over 20 years for fixed, 7% over 20 years for floating. So if your growth fund only gives you 6, the long-term projections of the mortgage is greater than the investment you'll gain. And then also you have things where you lose jobs, you get in a bad financial situation in an unexpected way, and the markets might have tanked. And usually they go hand in hand, because a tanked market or a global crisis is going to put pressure on your job, add to stress, and then family members might need support. So the best thing you can do if you own a mortgage on your home, pay it down as soon as possible. Still use your KiwiSaver, which is a 3% contribution. The reason I say that, because effectively your return is about 100%. You shouldn't really say it like that, but the gist is you put in 3%, they put in 3% after tax, the government puts in, so you're not going to get outpaced by debt. It's inaccessible, it's going to fund your retirement, and then the rest you go all into your mortgage to get it down as fast as possible and then start investing. Opinion on cryptocurrency. I have a lot of questions around cryptocurrency. The main thing about cryptocurrency, technology is amazing. If you're a business owner, you need to remain curious, because you could be in a position where you get outpaced by innovation and you're not thinking strategically on how you can be first, because it's easier to be first than it is to be the best. So I'm thinking about non-fungible tokens as a means to build community and connection, and also have a sustained revenue stream, not just for me, but them. So it becomes an investment, a community, and a growth opportunity for the business. In terms of investing in it, it's not diversified, it's not tax efficient, and you run the risk of not knowing which cryptocurrency is going to do well, or even if there's a new innovation that replaces it completely, like Blockbusters and Netflix. We had these videos, now we have streaming. Where the hell did Blockbuster go? That's what I'd say. No worries, mate. Nice tie. You're welcome. So I try to keep this efficient within 30 minutes every weekday, give or take if something happens in my life. So if you have questions, just make sure you have them ready. Kick them off, because I really want to make sure this is as valuable for you as possible. And also the podcast listeners can get more of a tailored current event approach to the podcast. So if you guys want to learn more, there's moneyskills.co.nz. It's a free initiative. I don't want money to stand between New Zealanders and living a more fulfilling life. So we're building up this platform. It's free. You can educate and learn about almost anything. There's the NZ Guide to Financial Freedom podcast. That's going to help people learn from the podcast 3 times a week. Pop out from some of the best guests that we can find. And there's one final question as we wrap this up. What would you recommend for an aspiring financial planner? CFP, Certified Financial Planner. Well, the thing about that's also a great degree. There's not many people that have that. You can even just get an authorized financial advisor license, which is quicker. So you can pump that out in 3 to 6 months and start practicing advice. But for most aspiring financial planners, the biggest thing you got to understand is what market are you going to serve, what problem do you solve, and how are you going to charge them. A lot of young aspiring financial planners try to service people that are younger than them or have some sort of problem that was prior to the problem they experienced, and now they've got the education and motivation. Challenge is it's hard to monetize that. So the main thing you want to think about is who you're going to help, what's the problem you're going to solve, and how you're going to monetize that problem. And then once you get clear on who you want, find out who the fisherman is of that industry. So think about it. If you really want to connect with people interested in retirement planning, you could go to accountants or family lawyers. Why that's important is they have access to 200 to 300 clients. They have trust. They know how much money they have. And they can also make a recommendation, because you can refer business back and forth. Some people need accountants for a taxation. Some people need family lawyers for enduring powers of attorneys and wills. So it's a synergetic relationship. So instead of you going direct to consumer, you go directly to the intermediaries. It's like befriending the fisherman. Every day you don't have to go out there and get the fish. You just have to make mates with 20 or so people that fish. Then you got fish for a lifetime. So then it becomes, how can you add disproportionate value to these intermediaries so they feel comfortable that they trust you, that you're helping their best interests, and you just got to pivot it differently, because most people want to connect with them. So that's what I'd say. Get clear on what problem you solve, what your ideal client is, and how you're going to monetize that, and then find your fishermen of the industry. So that's what I'd say. And if you want to chat, book a call. It's not actually in the link. If you go moneyskills.co.nz, it'll say book a call in the bottom right. Any new advisor, if I can help in any way, I'm happy to. You know, a rising tide lifts all boats. On that note, we're running out of time, team. I have 3 more papers left for CFP at uni. I'm 24. Nice, Sammy. Nice. Sammy Stoltz. Thank you. I will never forget this analogy. All good. But yeah, if you actually want to have a sit down and like actually get strategic, just moneyskills.co.nz, book a call, we'll have a chat, see if I can be helpful. But I got to go, team. Stick to the 30-minute window. So I hope you got value out of that, and thank you for the podcast listeners that suffering me trying to read, and the TikTok people for listening to me stutter my way through and get nervous but feeling okay. Cool. Thanks, team. And we'll catch you another time. See you later.